on weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
A big thanks to Beto da Silva for all his entertainment this afternoon. It's Monday the 9th of September and you're listening to Game On with me, Ruby Walsh. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7 o'clock, Alan Cawley and Stephen Kelly will discuss the golfing class between the Republic of Ireland and England, plus what we can expect from the boys in green against Greece tomorrow. In rugby, Bernard Jackman is in studio to talk rugby after a weekend of big results in the Southern Hemisphere. And in tennis, we reflect on the US Open success for Sinner and Sabalenka. All that plus the rest of our weekend sporting highlights. If you want to have your say, you can send us a text on 51552 or WhatsApp us on 087-187-9200 or we're on X at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Alan Cawley is in the studio this evening. Alan, how are you?
I'm good, Ruby. Yourself?
I'm great, thank God, Alan. I'm great, thank God. As you heard on the news, the Irish Paralympic team arrived in Dublin Airport shortly after 3 o'clock this afternoon. 6 medals, 12 top 4 placings, 6 personal bests and 5 national records. Athletes are always competitive, Alan, and will want more, but in the cold light of day, that's a good haul.
Oh, absolutely, Ruby, yeah. Some great scenes. I just saw some of the footage and, as you say, yeah, brilliant welcome home for them after such a brilliant performance just off the back of, obviously, the Olympics as well, sort of just carried on where all those athletes left off, and it's brilliant to see some great achievements, as you say, not just with the medals, PBs, all sorts of kind of personal achievements as well, and brilliant to see.
Brilliant to see is right. Obviously, the next Olympics is in 4 years' time in LA, so hopefully seeing is believing and we can build on what we've already achieved. There will be no Ellen Keane, Eve McChrystal or Ronan Grimes at the next Olympics. They have all retired and Ellen Keane is kindly going to join us on tomorrow night's show. But Alan, the weekend, had your highlight?
I did have a highlight, Ruby, yeah. It started right back on Friday, actually, off the back of probably what has been a bleak weekend for Irish football, but certainly there was a big highlight on Friday, and that's mine for the weekend, because the under-21s put in a brilliant performance. And there hasn't really been much talk about it, and I'm a bit disappointed with that, because it really was a brilliant performance. I was covering the game. They've put themselves in a position now, Ruby, obviously looking forward to tomorrow. They're playing Latvia, but they've put themselves in a position where if they beat Latvia tomorrow at home in Tala, they'll be 1 point clear of Italy and top of the table with 2 games remaining, and those 2 games will be against Norway and Italy, who are currently their kind of nearest challengers. So they've given themselves an unbelievable chance to create history. It'll be the first time they'll have ever qualified for European Championship under 21, and I'd love to see them do it. I know Jim Crawford very well, he's doing a great job, and I am a little bit disappointed that there hasn't been much talk about it, because it was a brilliant away performance to beat Turkey.
I'm afraid when the senior team get kicked off the park, it usually means the underage teams won't get any press.
Yeah, and of course, like, we're going to get into that in terms of, I suppose, the debacle really on Saturday, but as you say, kicked off the park, that's exactly what they were, and we will discuss that. But just, I just feel still in all, even though there's a lot of doom and gloom around Irish football at the moment, I think it's brilliant what the under 21s are doing, and some real quality players, and we're crying out for players, Ruby, as you well know. Obviously all the airwaves have been discussing all sorts of things about Irish football, but we are crying out for players, and there's lots of talent, believe me, in those under 21s now.
Well, the youth is the future.
Yeah, and the big question then is, can they obviously progress on? Hopefully not all of them are going to come true, but certainly if we could get 3 or 4, and I could earmark 3 or 4 right now who I think will, in my view and my opinion, who could go on to have a really big future in the game, and obviously represent our senior team as well. And that's what we have to be looking forward to, because what they're doing at the moment is really, really good. They were beaten in a playoff the last time around against Israel. I felt they missed the trick in that one, because there was lots of players who were still eligible who could have dropped down and played, and for whatever reason they didn't and they weren't allowed, and the Israeli team actually dropped down 3 players to play in that playoff, and ultimately we were beaten by them. But now they're through, obviously, in this campaign. They've won 5 games out of the 7. If they win tomorrow against Latvia, as I say, they'll go top. They should beat Latvia, although it won't be easy. Latvia have been doing okay themselves in the group, sitting on 7 points, but we should be beating Latvia if we've aspirations to progress. And then they'll put themselves in a position where it'll be a shootout with 2 games to go against Norway and Italy, and I'd love to see them do it.
Did you watch anything else over the entire weekend other than soccer?
Not really, no. I was watching, although we should mention Ronaldo, I suppose, an unbelievable feat, and he gets plenty of stick, but in terms of his achievements, Ruby, they're absolutely phenomenal. Still going. I was watching the match. Scotland put in a great performance. McTominay, who we both like, does great things for Scotland. I wouldn't have got rid of him at Man United, but he does great things for Scotland, scored a great goal. They were defending probably from then on, Scotland, and it looked like they might hold out for a draw, but that man pops up again time after time. Is he 39 years of age now, still doing it, 901 goals. And I saw a thing today, a kind of tongue in cheek comment really, but someone said on social media that he'll definitely hang around until he reaches 1,000, and we're all here to see it. He'll be about 44 by the time he does that, Ruby, but he'll be hanging around.
He probably will be. I don't think you can let it go or let the weekend go without mentioning Eddie Dunbar, who won his second stage in the Vuelta a Espana at the weekend as well, finished 11th overall behind Primo Roglic, the Slovenian, winning his fourth Vuelta, which is a fair performance for him. And one I'm going to mention, Alan, is Pat Foley, who had a winner at Kentucky Downs at the weekend with a filly called Special One. Now, Pat, obviously, his dad Tom trained Danoli many years ago, but a small trainer in rural Carlo, got a good filly called Special One. An American syndicate called Team Valor stepped in and bought her. They left her with Pat. He brought her to Kentucky at the weekend, where she won a big race. Now she's staying in America after that, but I still think it's a fair performance for a young man who was raised in the National Hunt game to be dipping his tip in the flat, or dipping his toe in the flat, and I most certainly tip my hat to him.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. Fair play to him.
It is, yeah. I saw a great one as well yesterday, Alan. I was watching Longchamp, and Roger Varian trained the favourite Charian running in the Prix de Moulin. Sylvester D'Souza rode him, and the race didn't go to plan, and Tribalist, the pacemaker in front, got away under Mikel Barcelona, and look, it got away. The result probably should have been the other way around, but look, these things happen in sport. But I just thought Roger Varian's attitude in defeat, he just said there's no point in getting in the jockey's back, the race got away, and he left it there. I just thought he showed a fair bit of class. There was the easy thing to do was just point at Sylvester D'Souza, but when you looked at it, it was the shape of the race, and I just thought there was a bit of class in taking defeat on the chin.
Yeah, and that's brilliant when you hear that, I suppose, from the jockey's point of view, the support and what he will receive from the trainer saying that, Ruby. But on that, I watched the race and I saw a notable speech that were saying the ground affected him, I think Charlie Appleby was saying, was he? But on that, when you say the horse got away, if you're on, obviously, the really good horses and you're primed for position midfield or wherever you are, and he's the pacemaker, at what point, Ruby, do you start one kind of, not panicking, but do you think we're giving him a bit too much rope here? Because you do see it from time to time.
But it only takes 100 metres, Alan, for it to be gone on you.
Okay.
So you only have to get 100 metres in a horse race is probably
split second stuff?
Not split second, maybe 3-4 seconds.
Okay.
So it's a bit more. It's in a flat race. It's 6.5 seconds, actually. But if you're Sylvester D'Souza, you're looking at Ryan Moore just in front of you on the Ballydoyle horse, and you're thinking, Ryan is going to follow him. Ryan is going to follow him. Ryan, go and follow him. All of a sudden, he's gone.
But on that, yeah, and that makes sense
that's
to me.
That's all it takes.
And that makes sense to me, Ruby, because obviously you're looking at the Ballydoyle horse, who time after time would be the favourite, and Ryan the best jockey, so you're taking your lead off him. But should you not have more responsibility for yourself and be riding for your...
You do, but I'm only explaining to you what Sylvester would have been thinking. So okay, he rounds down into the fall straight in Longchamp before the turn in, and he's thinking, Ryan is going to go. Ryan is going to go. You only have to think about it for a couple of seconds, and all of a sudden it's over. And that's what happens. Yeah. You're expecting, because as soon as Sylvester D'Souza pulls out and goes to Ryan Moore, Ryan is going to go. So Sylvester is hoping that Ryan, a bit like cycling, is going to tow him. But Ryan doesn't move, Sylvester eventually has to go, and you just get caught out. But look, everyone is human, people make mistakes. Stephen Kelly, I know he's on the line. What about the mistakes in the Aviva at the weekend, Stephen?
a few decent performances as well. Equivian, I thought, was excellent. Goalkeeper stepping in like that, not getting much game time at all, but to, you know, in a big performance against a big side. And mistakes, it's mistakes and it's switching off at moments, but then you get punished by better teams, and that's what happened. And I think throughout the game they looked just far superior. It was chalk and cheese between us and them. The way they move the ball, the way they pass the ball, the way they can dictate the tempo of play, everything about them was just a team that it's just so much better than what we are. And, you know, us to get to those levels, you know, it's been a long time, I think, since an England team were that far away from an Irish team. So I you always worry going into the match, and 2-0, I think it is respectable. I would almost take that on the back of what I saw in the first half, you know, better show in the second half. But it was tough to watch at times, but listen, it was half expected.
I completely agree, Alan. I'd be completely into form, and to me, England are miles ahead of the Republic of Ireland right now, and I only saw what I expected to see. Yet reading the fallout and all the opinions, a lot of people seem surprised.
Yeah, I wouldn't certainly be surprised about the result, and I don't think anyone should be, because as you say, the gulf in class is like astronomical, really, when you look at the players that were on show. And to be fair to those players as well, it's one thing to have superior quality, you still have to turn up and do it and deliver. And the likes of those games, foreign England or a superior team in an FA Cup tie or something, can be a potential banana skin, and that's what it could have been for England. But unless you turn up with that professional approach, approach the game properly, which they did. Carsley obviously did a great job, and the players he picked as well. Some hungry lads like Gordon, Grealish out to prove a point, and they were absolutely fabulous, England. The disappointment for me, Ruby, was you have to ask the question as to why it was so easy for England. And it's not just down to the fact that there were better players and that they're brilliant. If you look at the setup, and this is what disappointed me most, we played with effectively, you have your three centre halves but and wing backs, but it was like a flat back five at times, and they were pinned in so deep that all you had in the middle was Malumbi and Smallbone, effectively against four. Because if you have Rice and Maynard, who were the two, you have Trent, who we see dropping in all the time at Liverpool into that kind of inverted midfield role, pinging balls like we've seen from the first goal, and then you have Grealish roaming all over the place. So I actually felt so sorry for Malumbi and Smallbone, because it doesn't matter who you are, if you've two midfielders in there against three or four, forget about it, especially against the quality of England. And that surprised me, Ruby, that we were set up so naively against England. Because if you look at Harry Kane up against three centre halves and he drops in deep, our three centre halves were redundant, really, because they weren't marking anybody. All the players were out in the middle of the pitch with overloads everywhere against our two midfielders. Then you had Smodic and Ogbeni, who were trying to kind of get up the pitch and press, and there was just gaps everywhere. It got a little bit better in the second half when we changed the shape and they brought the third man in. Obviously Jason Knight came in as a three in midfield, and that's the way we should have started, I felt, just to give ourselves any sort of a chance. But if you're playing with the two in there against anybody, especially a team as good as England with the players that they have, that's why we got destroyed.
Tough first game all the same for Hemer Hallgrimsson. I haven't said a man's name. Hallgrimsson. Were you surprised, like Alan obviously was, with how he set up, Stephen? Were you surprised he set up so defensively?
I'm not surprised he set up defensively, but I agree with Alan in the sense that you're playing against a team that they will dominate midfield in the best of games, against better sides, and to leave us in a position where we're kind of just really outmatched in that position. You see even Steve Rice's goal, he's running off Smallbone, and you kind of think, if we think of Will Smallbone, Alan and I would have spent a lot of time watching with the 21s, and I've seen it a few times with Southampton as well, and you're kind of thinking he can do the box-to-box stuff, he can be a midfielder in that defensive role, but he's the one that links the play between the midfield and attack. He's the one you want to hard to pitch. And a game like this, listen, you expect him to have to do defensive duties. But when you are overmatched and overrun in there, when you've got three players in there, sometimes four for England stepping in. But I think the difference with England is their movement between the lines. This is a team that's played a lot more together. I know there's a few new faces in it, but they seem to have an idea of what they wanted to do earlier. And I think there was the pure dominance in ball. They just felt like so much more confident, whereas we were just kind of clinging on. I think it's weird because you watch it and you kind of think, where was the fight? Where was the spirit? Like, someone put a tackle in, get about them. That's what you kind of feel like Ireland need to be effective in these games. And that was lacking. But we were also, you're one step in our place away from someone absolutely cutting you to pieces. And I've been in games like that. I've been against teams that are far superior than what we are, that I've been in. And your concentration levels are through the roof to try and not make a mistake, to not switch off, to not track that runner. And it's difficult. But yeah, it was disappointing at times. But like I said, it's three or four games into this new manager's tenure. I would have liked us to see it being a bit more solid. I think defensively we made mistakes. There's individual errors as well that cost goals, and you can't legislate for that as a new manager. But I think we're going to have to see over the course of the next couple of games with Greece is more of it. Yeah, I mean, you're going to judge this guy more against Greece tomorrow than we are against England on Saturday.
We most certainly are, Alan. Obviously, Greece beat Finland 3-0 on Saturday evening. They're coming to Dublin tomorrow. If you're John O'Shea and Heimer Hallgrimsson, what way do you set up tomorrow night?
I watched Greece Saturday night, Ruby, and they were brilliant. So this is going to be a tough game as well. Obviously, and they're a step above us at the moment. They're not quite England. They're not that far ahead of us, but they're a step above us. They beat us twice in the last campaign as well. So this is going to be a tough, tough game. And they have to learn lessons from the other night. There's no way they can go into the Greece game with two in midfield either. They have to get a third body in there, numbers wise. The question is, do you play a back four? I was disappointed that Scales didn't play as well. I thought Scales would have had a chance, especially in a three. So I was surprised he didn't play. I would ask questions over Matt Doherty and Robbie Brady as your wing backs as well, because on that side of the pitch, especially if you're playing with wing backs, you need fellas that can run up and down the pitch. Robbie Brady, legs. Ogbeni, that was another thing why we improved a little bit in the second half, because when you brought Jason Knight in as a three, and you had Ogbeni then as right wing back, who actually has the legs and the power to get up and down the pitch and a bit of pace, and he offers a threat, I thought we looked a little bit better. So they're the things you would be expecting the manager to see from the second half to introduce to the game to make us that a little bit better tomorrow night, Ruby. But the question at the moment is, the manager is kind of saying he's leaning on John and Paddy. And I'd love to think that was for this game, and now he's seen them, and tomorrow he's the manager and he needs to make the decisions. I'm sure he is making the decisions, but he needs to come out and take a bit of authority and show that tomorrow. I understood in the build up to the England game why he was doing that and saying, I'm leaning on John and Paddy a little bit, because obviously I'm new to the country, I don't really know the players. But I'm sure he's looked at tapes and videos of all the last few matches, and he would have a fair idea, whether you know the players or not, of exactly what we're all about. So I would love to think tomorrow now, even the fact that there was nobody, he wasn't there in the press conference, leaves so many doubts and question marks.
Before you go, hang on a second, we'll listen to that press conference, because it was John O'Shea who was at the press conference today, and we do have it, so we'll just play that and listen to it.
It's only very simple. This plan was in place beforehand. And it's obviously to give the boss as much time in terms of preparation, the quick turnaround in the game as well. So that was always been the case. So there's no change.
And there's no fear that there'd be a confusion among the players as to who the real gaffer is?
Totally. No fear at all, because the boss is the boss. There's clear lines on that. As I mentioned, this is the plan that was in place beforehand, and we felt there was no reason to change it.
He talked about a management team with yourself, Paddy, and obviously the rest of the members of the staff as well. In your review of the game, what have you learned?
Most importantly, you reflect straight away, but the manager wants to get across as clearly as he can, as quickly as he can, obviously what he's looking for. So the good references, and obviously the references that we have to improve on. Simple as that. You play against a team that have just been in the Euros final. You know you're going to be under plenty of pressure in a game like that, and obviously because the fact it was England too brings that extra bit more scrutiny as well. So clearly room for improvement, we know that. We know England were the best team on the day, but now thankfully you have another chance to put in a performance against Greece quite quickly.
Heimer talked about, I suppose, a lack of confidence at times as well. How can you put that right in such a short space of time?
Yeah, look, that's the beauty of having the game so quickly. I think that's the benefit when you have that two-game window. You know, it's a short turnaround, and even when you think ahead to October, November, it's a Thursday-Sunday scenario, so it's even quicker again in terms of that scenario. But it's very clear, we know we have things to improve on, and we work on it. We get the chance to work on it today, and obviously we'll have more time in the morning to touch on things as well before the final preparation, travelling into the game.
Stephen, do you think that he's approaching it right, observing his first two games, getting a feel for it before he puts a shape on things?
No, I don't. I don't think you can do that as a manager. I've been in situations, not internationally, but league football. And internationally, it's different because you only have 3 or 4 days to work with him. But like, I've been in a team where we've got Neil Warnock in to save us with a few games to go, and he comes in, and the first day he's dictating, smashing us, he's telling you what to do. I want this from you. He has to be doing that. I can't imagine him not doing that. I don't know whether this is something the FA are doing, or just to kind of keep the wolves at bay or something at the start. I don't really get it. Maybe, listen, John's a good public figure to have out there. He can't really get too much criticism because he's not really done anything wrong. So I can understand that point of view. But There's no way he's not taking an influence on this or putting a stamp on it. You can't do that as a manager. You have to be, within a day, you can make an impact on players. Within 20 seconds of meeting them, you could tell them how you want to be, if you like them, if you're, be aggressive, whatever it is, you can change their mindset or give something to them that's going to put you as the person that's going to dictate how we're going to play, even if it's the smallest detail, that one thing you want them to do, you could get that across in a day. So I don't think that you need, I think you do need time to bed in your exact formation and shape and system, but little point of view of how you want them to play are easy to get across to professionals that have played for a long time.
Alan, obviously managers are expected to talk to the media the day before a game. Would you accept that he was just too busy and that John O'Shea was always going to do this?
Well, they said the reason for it was that was always the plan, Ruby, but I just think off the back of the criticism they've taken for... Now, let me just go back before the match. So I actually get why he's saying he was leaning on John and Paddy or whatever in the build-up. I can kind of take that for the first match. But once that match is out of the way in England, and especially the way the performance transpired and how poorly we were beaten, albeit by a better team as we know, but just in terms of the mistakes and different things, he has to come out today and show authority, basically. And whether that was set up or not, that John was, that was the plan originally, like John said, and you can only take him at his word, but whether that was the case or not, that could be easily changed, and the manager could easily go to whoever it is in the FEI and say, I'm doing the press conference today, especially off the back of the criticism that they've taken for him basically saying he's leaning on Paddy and John. So if he comes out and does that, that quells all the uncertainty straight away, Ruby, and I would have done that if I was him today, because here we are discussing it tonight, all the journalists are discussing it, people on social media are discussing it, people are saying who's in charge, who's the manager. So the optics of it is really, really poor. So like Stephen said, one game in I can kind of take, but tomorrow is so important. He should have shown authority today, and I hope to God he's shown authority back in the camp, picking the team, getting his message out there straight away. Win, lose or draw, he has to make the first steps and show everybody that he's the manager, because I was a bit disappointed with the way it played out today.
Stephen, to me, I'm not an expert on this, but to me, looking in, Ogbeni looked the only player quick enough for this level. Speed is the one thing that's common across every sport. We not just need faster players.
You do need fast players. You do need athleticism, and the game is about it's about running, but then it's about quality as well. Like, and the best teams in the world have the players that are quickest, the strongest, can do it for the longest, and then at the end of that can actually produce something. And that's the difference between the best players in the world and the others. Ogbeni is absolutely rapid, but are we utilising... So if you're playing Ogbeni up front, like Alan said, you're playing him in the forward areas, and he looks a real threat, and he constantly goes... You know, listen, sometimes he gets into the space and he doesn't produce exactly what you want him to produce, but if he was producing that 9 times out of 10, he wouldn't be at Luton and Ipswich. He'd be at a Tottenham manner. You know, that's the level he'd be at. But he's where he is because of, in those final turns, he, all time, he doesn't get the right decision. But is he a genuine threat with his pace? Absolutely. Can we utilise him more? If we're going to be backs against the wall for a whole game, like Alan said, I'm very surprised where he's never been operating in a wing-back role, because he would get a lot more of the ball there, and he can help us out in attacking sense. I know you don't want to take away from him going forward, but sometimes I've always thought to myself, why hasn't he operated? You talk about legs and speed and energy, and he is all of those things. And there's other players in the team that are quick, like, you know, the centre-backs, like O'Shea and Collins. Like, they're big boys, but they're no slouches. They might not be the quickest over the turn, but over a distance they can move. So, you know, we're not struggling for speed. England, they're blessed with pace. That's the difference. they're completely blessed with ridiculous pace in so many areas, and passers that can put them in. You know, we might be getting aged a bit. You talk about Robbie Brady and Doherty and Seamus. You know, those lads are not going to be been able to do it for 90 minutes every game at the level they did before, because it doesn't happen in football. You get to a certain age. But yeah, we are lacking that in forward areas.
Alan, what do you do tomorrow night? Kick the tree? And what do you change? How many do you change?
And in fairness, the one thing we have to say as well, Ruby, this is a new manager. He needs time. He needs a chance. We have to give him that time and give him that chance and that opportunity. You're not going to play England every match, which is obviously a big plus. But these are the games that people will obviously be judging him on, the likes of the Finland-Greece game, even though I think Greece are definitely, I don't think it, I know Greece are a notch above us, but certainly we need to be competitive in that game. And if we could pick up something, a positive, a draw, if a win would be great to get him up and running, kind of thing. But I certainly think we need to see the shape of the team set up far better for the personnel that we have. And I don't think it doesn't wash with me that, oh, he's only had three or four training sessions. He would have been looking at video since the day he was announced. Mm-hmm. And if you go back to the FBI and them saying that he was the man for the first manager that we wanted and he was earmarked for the last 10 months, well, surely if that was the case, he would have known, if I'm taking this job, he would have been checking out everything to do with Ireland and the way we play for the last 10 months if that was the case. So that doesn't wash with me either. He obviously wasn't, as we know why he was so surprising when he got the job. But now that he's in it, I think we have to give him a chance, give him that opportunity. But certainly, whatever about playing England and them being a better team, which we all know, and better players, I still think he can set up the team and the shape in a way which you don't get dismantled the way we did. And I hope to see that tomorrow night, that we learn from those mistakes on Saturday.
I hope you do too, Stephen. There was loads of other games across the last couple of days since last Thursday, English Nations League. A few, I don't know, eye-catching results maybe. Italy beating France 3-1. Spain has scored lots of goals. Germany beat Hungary 5-0. What caught your eye over the weekend?
France, Italy won. That one, I think, caught my eye. I think the open few moments was the Barcola scored early on in that game. And I think those seeing clips of Donovan McNabb hadn't even had his gloves on. Almost when he scored, that one caught my eye. And I just, with us, because I'm going to be in watching Greece tomorrow, I was watching the Greece game. I was interested in it. I was keeping my eye on it. I'm going to be covering it tomorrow 4:00 PM, so I was like, I had one eye fixed now. And I don't know whether it's made me a little bit more worried about going into this game, or a little bit more maybe excited to think that if we do get a result, that it's a big step for us, because I feel Greece almost may be in a slightly better place than they were when they beat us last time, and I don't know what position we're in. So I'm kind of feeling that this manager can get something out of the boys and get a result at home. I think it's a big, big scalp for us. I think it's bigger than what people will think. It's not just Greece. I think Greece looked very good in their game against Finland, like Alan said as well. They're just so dangerous in the wide areas. And if we can counter that and get a result at home, I'm kind of like, you know, I'd be excited about what the future holds if on the basis of that is a very good result.
It will be a very good result, Alan. You're off to watch France-Belgium tonight, Jesus.
France-Belgium tonight, Ruby. At Wales are also have a big game against Montenegro. But one that stuck out for me over the weekend, Ruby, and coming off the back of the Euros, because I fell in love with them during the Euros, Georgia beat Czech Republic 5-1. Oh, yeah. And they were absolutely brilliant again. Some of the goals they scored. And that just goes to show you, like, if Georgia can do it, we can do it, Ruby. But I'd be here all night trying to explain how we're going to do it. But it can be done, because to be fair to Georgia, whatever they're doing at the moment over there, it's phenomenal. In Tbilisi as well, the stadium looked absolutely brilliant, and they're riding the crest of a wave at the moment.
Before I let the two of you go, have a listen to Queevy and Gallagher today.
Listen, I think made it clear probably in the last few years now that I want to go be a number one and play week in, week out. And the club's made that decision to get another goalkeeper in as well, which obviously from the outside looking in, looks like they've made a decision to go a different direction. So yeah, but my ambition has always been clear, and has been clear the last few seasons, that I want to go be a number one and play week in, week out. And sometimes from the outside looking in, it looks like maybe that's 100% my decision, and maybe at times it's not always in my hands as well.
I know, with Kevin Bisuno out, he will be the number one for Ireland, but Alan Colley, how does he get out of Liverpool to be a number one somewhere else?
Yeah, I think he needs to force their hand now at this stage, Ruby, because we've heard him say it there straight from the horse's mouth that obviously he wants to get out, he wants to play. We used to have these chats a little bit uncertain and unsure as to whether his position on it, was he happy to just kind of stay behind Alisson, or did he want to go out? But we know now, he's after saying it there exactly, that he wants to go out. So I think he needs to force the club's hand. They're in a position where they'll obviously wait and see and get the best value for money for him, and I think that was the situation with Nottingham Forest. There was a paltry offer, I think, so the club are entitled to do that. But I think he needs to force their hand a little bit, because he's at the stage now, he's a brilliant goalkeeper. We saw him obviously at the weekend, and that's a big positive as well, Ruby, is that we have a great goalkeeper and we have Bisuno as well, so we have two good goalkeepers, something to build from. But I think he needs to get out and play, and he said it himself, and I hope to God he does.
Stephen, how do you force a club's hand to get out if they don't want to sell you?
You know what, I think with a club like Liverpool, if you have to have a straight up conversation with them, and like, so the clubs can be difficult. If you want to go sometimes, you're a young player, you might want to leave, you want to play all the time, and they don't want to let you go because they feel like you might be asset. But as a goalkeeper, your chances are so limited. Like as an outfield player, they'll say, listen, you could play next week, you could be in the team, you might end up being, whereas goalkeeper, the chances are so slim. So for him, it's got to be a conversation where, listen, if I'm not going to play, if I'm going to be third choice, and you don't want to sell me because I may be the first choice goalkeeper here, let me go on loan. Let me go and spread my wings and play week in, week out at a club that I can develop in and hone my craft. And that will be better for Liverpool in the long run of him actually getting game time. If it's not going to be a permanent move, then a loan move is something that they'd have to consider. But that's a conversation he has to have. And listen, the agents are going to be doing up to all sorts of shenanigans in the background and pulling people's hair out and trying to move pieces. Sometimes it has to be just down to you, and you go to the person that's in charge and say, listen, I feel I've given my best to this club. I feel I need an opportunity to enhance my career. Whether it's here, yes, I'd love to do it, but if it's not going to be here currently and it'll be here later, let me go on loan. I've got an opportunity. If it's not going to be a loan and you want to get a fee, make sure it's the right fit for me, because you don't want to be him signing for another team where he's going to be second choice, because there's a lot of clubs that would look at him and think, I'd love to pay a few quid for him and get him in, because he'd be a great backup to have. And he doesn't want to be backup again. He wants to go and actually play somewhere. So that's going to be a tough choice, because you probably have better options at better clubs, but you won't be guaranteed to play. He has to go somewhere he's guaranteed to play.
Well, we can guarantee you he will be playing tomorrow night. Alan Kelly and Stephen Cawley, thanks for taking our calls. That game is live here on 2FM tomorrow night at 7:45. But we've an ad to break, and when we come back, Bernard Jackman will be discussing rugby.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Now it's time to talk rugby, and I'm delighted to say that Bernard Jackman is in studio as the wheels slowly start to turn in Europe. Bernard, they've been turning a while in the Southern Hemisphere, and how's it all going down there?
Yeah, it's been amazing. Two brilliant test matches the last couple of weeks. South Africa against the All Blacks. You can see the All Blacks are trying to change how they play and trying to find a way to break down this South African defence. But obviously, they couldn't conquer in the World Cup final. And they've thrown a lot of stuff at South Africa, and they've had some success. But I think what's blown me away is just how hard it is to finally beat them, and the impact of the South African bench over the last 2 weeks has been absolutely massive, and it's leading to a lot of soul searching in New Zealand and a lot of talk around their structures, and particularly in the professional game, and how they're very much aligned to Australia. Obviously the South African franchises have come north, and you see Australia at the weekend, it got well beaten by a record defeat actually to Argentina. So being aligned to a country who are look like they're heading the wrong way isn't necessarily very very positive for New Zealand rugby, and they may be about to I suppose go into a period where things they won't be as dominant as they were in the past, although obviously we're going to have a look at them in November when they come to the Viva.
I'd say we are. But look, Scott Robertson has obviously taken over from Ian Foster after the World Cup, and I can't imagine the New Zealand press are going to give him an easy time.
No, they won't. Look, it's an incredibly hostile place to be if you're not successful. We saw that with Ian Foster after Ireland beat them the summer before last, when he really just had to fight to hang on to his job and suffered incredible abuse, not just from the public but from the media as well. So Robertson, in fairness, is very popular. He was the popular choice. He was someone that they thought should have got the job when Foster got it 4 years ago. Has had great success with the Crusaders, but the problem is he didn't have total freedom in terms of his own staff, and we saw one of his assistant coaches, Liam McDonald, depart a couple of weeks ago over a conflict of how they should be playing. And he I suppose maybe less coaches will be a help to him, because there has been some bright sparks in how they're performing, but again there's a lot of older players there that are kind of holding that team together. And that the big question mark in New Zealand rugby is where is the next generation coming from? And their under 20 sides over the last 5, 6, 7 years haven't been the same quality as what we would become used to. So it's a tricky one for him. He has a lot of experience. He knows New Zealand rugby. He's popular with the players. I think he'll be fine, but there may be some dark days ahead in terms of getting results, particularly against the top teams like Ireland, France, South Africa. You know, New Zealand are never going to fall too far away, but the last 2 weeks I think will have been hard for them, because they saw, even though the scores were reasonably tight, there still was a gulf against the box, and that's kind of how the box play. They can hammer you and batter you without putting up a big score. It's just the mark they leave physically, and that was very impressive from their point of view.
Did it surprise you then the weekend to watch South Africa turn down 5 penalties? I mean, they've Andre Pollard on the pitch, yet there was 5 kickable penalties that South Africa didn't take. They're changing slightly the way they play as well. They're trying to evolve too, by the looks of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And ironically, you know, a part of that shift is New Zealand influence. A fellow called Tony Brown, who was former Otago Highlander, former All Black, but did great things with Japan. He was the attack coach when Japan beat Ireland in the World Cup in 2019, and he has come in there, and you can see that shift in their mentality, because they were always happy to take points. And why wouldn't you when you have someone like Andrew Pollard and you have a four pack who can get you into the right areas of the field? But they are looking to evolve themselves, and they also, I think, they trust the impact of their bench, and they feel even if they don't score a try and turn down points, that the effort that it takes from the team defending to stop you will pay a little bit later on when they have the quality that the others don't to bring on for impact. But yeah, it's and the great thing for Razzy Erasmus, I know they lost to Ireland in the second test, but they're managing to win, blood new players and evolve a game plan which, you know, has led them to 2 back-to-back World Cups, so that's really positive from their point of view, that they're finding new talent and instead finding other ways to play as well.
You read the New Zealand press and they're giving out like mad, and then you read the South African press and they're delighted that Khaleesi has gone from Racing Metro, he's coming back to play with the Sharks, and they described him as a liberated player last Saturday.
Yeah, look, he's been brilliant. And look at it. I mean, Jackie Lorenzetti, the president of Racing 92, he was quite scathing about his impact and said he'd come to France to Paris to eat baguettes and croissants, and didn't put the performances on the field that they basically felt they were going to get when they signed him and paid him huge money. It's obviously he wasn't happy there. It's obvious that he's very comfortable and is trusted by the South African management team. Obviously, he's captain of the side, and some of his performances the last couple of weeks have been outstanding, you know. And he's signed for the Sharks, so we're going to get to see him in the URC. He's still quite a young man. There's lots of rugby left in him, and that move back to South Africa. I think he said his family didn't really settle. He wants to be closer to home. And now he's got that, but certainly over the last couple of weeks, his impact, because it's so hard in the South African back row. They've got such quality, so never to start is a big achievement. Never mind be captain, but he's certainly proven his worth.
The rugby championship really is a tale of two halves, isn't it? I mean, you've Scott Robertson under pressure, Razzy Erasmus delighted. Then you go to the other side of the draw. You've Joe Schmidt wondering what's he after taking on, and Felipe Contepone must be in dreamland with Argentina.
Yeah, look, Felipe. I mean, he got his first win. Argentina's first win in New Zealand a couple of weeks ago. Then the second test, you know, they weren't competitive. Then they were 17 points down against Australia at the weekend, and then just came back and just played unbelievable rugby. I think his first job as a head coach, obviously I was lucky enough to play with him in Leinster, an amazing player, and has taken his time. He's obviously, you know, got out of the game for a little while, finished off his medical studies, then came back in, came over to Leinster as a attack coach, went back to Argentina and worked under Michael Checa, and now has the job in his own right. And that result against Australia, and the manner in which they turned it around and obviously just found their attacking shape, and just were ruthless. And I think Joe Schmidt
points.
Yeah, 64
points in 48 minutes against the team managed by Joe Schmidt. Did he put the team back on the pitch? Did half not go out, or what happened?
I think Joe, we know there's a bit of a talent deficit in Australia. He is trying to find the best players. Some of their players that were a big part of the last regime, their outside backs in particular, have decided to go back and play rugby league, which is booming in Australia. So he doesn't have the experience that his predecessor had, Eddie Jones had it, but he didn't make much use of it. But Dave Rennie before him. Joe Schmidt's a brilliant coach. It's just a case of, it's a race against time, Ruby, to be ready for the British and Irish Lions, and a defeat like that on Saturday, that many points, it's going to be hard to take. It's going to knock some of those young players' confidence, and it's probably the biggest test of Joe Schmidt's career to put together an international side, given the issues in the domestic game there, that can be competitive against the British and Irish Lions. And as I said, like, it's unfortunately that's the expectations I think you realistically have to have for him now, is to be competitive, not win a series. When you look at the strength that's in Ireland and England in particular that they can pick from.
Obviously your interest in all facets of rugby, and you watch what else is going on down there. Tonga, Fiji, Japan, USA, Samoa, Canada, they're playing a competition of their own. What rugby is trying to encompass more nations, make it a bigger sport, make it more global. Have you seen any of those catching up, bridging the gap between the top and the second tier?
Not for the moment, Ruby, to be honest. It's very tough because a lot of those, bar Japan, where all the players play domestically, a lot of the other countries, top players have to play in Europe or Japan, and the only time they really get them all back together with a proper preparation period is for the World Cup. But this competition is gonna help them. It will help them find, you know, new talent, particularly from the Pacific Islands. And I suppose the roadmap for them is obviously they have their own team in the Super Rugby now, Manoa Pacifica, which is a help, so 35 of them can stay in the islands and play professional rugby. But the reality is the best way for them to increase the player pool is for some of those players to get picked up and find international contracts elsewhere and be available for Rugby World Cups rather than this competition, which is really is only development at the end of the day. It's not the same standard as the Rugby Championship or the Six Nations, but by increasing their player pool, eventually they'll have enough depth to be able to hopefully go toe-to-toe with the top-tier countries, especially the ones like Australia, who are maybe just going through a little bit of a rebuild, and pick off the odd one of those and just start to climb up the rankings.
Obviously, the top 14 even kicked off at the weekend. Obviously, it's 14 teams. 7 were victorious. Clermont, Stade Toulousain, Bordeaux Beagles, La Rochelle, Lyon, Cast and Bayonne. Did you watch any of it?
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a little bit of chat in La Rochelle. Obviously, Jordy Barrett is coming to Leinster, but Damien McKenzie could be going to La Rochelle.
Yeah, it'd be a huge recruit for Ron O'Gara and La Rochelle. Look, at La Rochelle, they didn't have the same success last season that they've had in previous years, and they're a club with massive ambition, massive drive. So if someone like Damien McKenzie can be lured in at this stage of the season, he's box office, and particularly the way O'Gara, I think, wants to play and to evolve his attack. I think they are evolving. I mean, they probably won 2 European Cups with a lot of brute force and no little skill in the back of it, but that was their point of difference. Whereas, you know, some of those big men are starting to get closer to retirement age, and you can see some of the recruits that Roland's made are certainly a different profile, and he's looking to evolve. And someone like McKenzie, who can obviously play 10 fullback and has the quality he has to break down defences, would be an incredible signing. And look, they got off to a good start, won at home at the weekend over a Toulon side who are starting to look like they're going to be challenged again. So last year they had a really tough start to the season with obviously so many players at the World Cup, and that kind of gave them an impossible task to try and climb back up the table. Whereas I think this year they've had a good pre-season, and I think they'll be in a good place by the turn of the year.
No fairy tale debut for Owen Farrell. Racing went down by 3 points to Cast, but he'll make his impact there, won't he?
I think Stuart Lancaster was adamant he needed a 10 that could control the game. There's so much X factor and talent in that squad, but they were lacking a lot of direction, so he went out and paid the big money to lure Owen Farrell over there. Obviously they have a relationship from when Stuart was coaching England, and that's a good result. And they got a losing bonus point away to Cast. They actually probably should have won the game, probably won the tackles of the season. Racing made a line break, and Spring, the fullback, was true. He got tackled out of nowhere, which saved Cast the victory. So I think the Racing showed enough to that Stuart Lancaster will feel that this season is going to be a lot better, and you can be sure if Owen Farrell stays fit, he'll be playing a big role in that.
No doubt he will. Obviously, the URC is back on Friday the 20th of September, not that far away. Edinburgh will, of course, or Leinster travel to Edinburgh. At Inter Probity, Munster and Connacht. Ulster play Glasgow at home as well on Saturday the 20th. Any vibes from the provinces? Any good news, bad news? Anything you can tell us?
Yeah, look, I think Leinster, they seem to have had a very tough and intense pre-season. I think Jack Dienabar has certainly enjoyed being there for pre-season. Obviously, he came in late last year after the World Cup. Tyler Blindale, the new attack coach, the former Munster out half, is making a big impression. So the soundings from Leinster are positive. Obviously, RG Snyman isn't going to be fit for the start of the season. He's picked up a bit of a knock. But I don't think, and Barrett is coming after Christmas. Like, Barrett and Snyman were signed for the knockout stages of the URC and for the Champions Cup. I think we all accept that Leinster's squad depth is so good that they're going to be there without them, but obviously they need a little bit of help to get over the line. So Leinster seemed to be in a decent place. Munster had a loss to Gloucester at the weekend, but again, it's an opportunity for some young players to play and get a chance. So I wouldn't read too much into pre-season, but I'm really looking forward to seeing them all get going in round one and see who has put their hand up in pre-season and is ready to stake a claim for game time, both for the province and maybe for Ireland later on the year.
Well, we can't wait till it's back because it gives us something extra to talk about on a Monday. Bernard Jackman, thanks a million for coming in. Please don't go away because after the break, we'll be looking back at the US Open.
Game on.
Football.
Welcome back to Game On. I know I promised tennis, but Alan Colley, what has just broken the last few minutes in Dundalk?
Yeah, a statement has just been released, Ruby, and it's kind of just confirming all the rumours and the reports that we've been hearing over the past 5 to 7 days ever since John Daly made that statement after the match about the players hadn't been paid. So it's the owner, Brian Ainscough, as I say, confirming those reports to say that they are true. He is basically also saying he was hoping to secure investment in August, but for various reasons that did not come true. His most immediate concern now is that the club can carry on for the remainder of the season. He's actively seeking investment and exploring all possibilities about the ownership of the club to ensure that happens, and he said he will continue to speak to any interested parties, and I remain fully positive that we can secure the injection of cash that we need to keep us going. He also mentioned about those wages that he basically apologised to the players, and he's hoping that can be resolved, that it's only temporary and it can be resolved in the coming days. But not good, Ruby. The reports, as I said, all confirmed, and Dundalk are in major trouble.
They most certainly are. Difficult times for the Loud soccer team. We wish them well and hope that a resolution is found. Now, I did promise tennis, so Fabio Mole from the Functional Tennis Podcast joins us on the line. Fabio, your fellow Italian, Yannick Sinner strolled onto Arthur Ashe and didn't delay winning the US Open.
He did. He had me in bed at 9:30 last night, which was great. Yannick had a great win against Taylor Fritz, who the crowd were mostly up for. And it marked a great year for Yannick, who's won Australia and the US Open, sharing the slams at Alcaraz.
Exactly. 6-3, 6-4, 7-5 was the winning verdict. But he did turn up in America under some bit of a cloud. Obviously, he was found not guilty by the International Tennis Integrity Agency and an independent tribunal after failing two dope tests earlier in the year. That cloud did hang over him a bit, but it didn't seem to get in his way.
It did. I think his first round match, he lost a set to Mackenzie McDonald and was a breakdown. I think that's about as hard as it got to him. It took him a bit of time to adjust, but I think he's taken it head on. He's answered questions. He's been up front. He feels himself. He's done nothing wrong, and that's given him inner peace. So I think he's handled the situation pretty good. There is the usual, a lot of comments online, and as you get with these things. But I think overall he's at peace with it. He did have some family issues. His auntie is not good health-wise, so he dedicated the win to her. And he's kept, since this issues the past few months has arrived, he's kept his team very, very close, and he's shut out most of the world.
He most certainly did, and let his tennis do the talking. Obviously, no joy, for Carlos Alcaraz and Novak Djokovic, who both bowed out quite early. Surprising?
It is. There's been the whole talk about the Olympics this year. too many tennis events. It's a yearly talk that there's too many tennis events. They need to, you know, give the players more breaks. And I think it's caught up with a lot of the male and female players. Even Iga Świątek, she went out early. And it's just been really tough. They looked, normally the tour finals at the year end in November, they look a bit jaded, a bit tired. You know, if they get broken early in matches, they just like shut off and they lose. And it seems like those vibes were happening in the US. So they're definitely playing a lot of tennis, and the Olympic year hasn't helped them.
Arina Sabalenka of Belarus, 2 sets, 7-5, 7-5, beat Jessica Pegula. But it did kind of resemble last year a little bit when Coco Gauff beat her. It wasn't all plain sailing for Sabalenka, even if it was only 2 sets.
No, I thought it was a great match. Jessica Pegula said she couldn't have done anything better. She did really well, but Sabalenka did have a bit of a slip, but she got back on top of it. And I think it was 2 years ago where she said she dropped her psychologist. She had to take, you know, she had to learn for herself, take everything on herself. And since then, she's been unbelievable. I know her team is great. They help her a lot. But a lot of the bad parts of her game, she had the issues with her serve. She's cleaned all that up. And she's just a lot stronger mentally. And when things get tight for her, she just hits the ball harder.
Well, she did hit it harder. The women's game, the men's game, obviously we had a golden generation of men's players. Djokovic is coming to the end. The others are gone. Well, maybe not Rafa quite yet, but is tennis going to have another golden generation? Are the likes of Jannik Sinner and Taylor Fritz, is there enough players coming to keep tennis where it needs to be?
I think there is. I think Alcaraz is probably the main person here who he's the most exciting player to watch. You just don't know what he's going to do. He's different game styles. He can do everything else. He can do everything. Sinner's more, you know, Sinner hits probably the hardest hitter out there. Well, not according to the facts, where Sabalenka was actually hitting the ball the hardest of all the players, the male and the females, which is incredible. But in general, Sinner's the hardest hitter. He's more of a, you know, baseline game. But Alcaraz can serve and volley, hits the slices, drop shots, mix it up. And I think just him alone, there's enough to keep tennis going. And then him and Sinner, I don't think they're as good as the wolf pack of Federer, Djokovic and Nadal and a bit of Murray there, which they kept everything close to themselves. But if you look at the year they've had between Alcaraz winning 2 slams, Sinner winning 2 slams, I think they've a good control of tennis, and they're both only 22 and 23.
Great ages, 22 and 23. You mentioned there that there was a lot of tennis this year. Will anybody in the ATP or in world tennis do anything about that, or is that just going to be the way?
I think it's just the way it's going to be. You know, money talks, and obviously the players moan about it, but they have commitments, but, you know, they win, they earn a lot of money, and they don't like missing these events, so it's not that they're just going to disappear and not play events unless they're injured. And I don't think nothing looks like to be happening, because they get like 3 or 4 weeks off, but then there's exhibition matches, they play exhibition. So I see myself as a bit, you know, money gets in the way of things, and obviously ATP earns money from events, and there's all sort of license deals and sponsorship deals where players have to play events as well. I can't see it changing at all unless the players decide, look, we're just not playing, and that's the only thing I can see happening.
Well, it's very unlikely to happen, Fabio, and I think there's lots of other sports in pretty much the same boat, but I'm afraid that's all we have time for. Thanks a million for taking our call. Thanks to Ronan Lawler, who produced. I'll be back tomorrow night, and of course we will have Ellen Keane.